ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi there, Selena Green bringing you The Country Hour again today. Well, yes, spoiler alert in the news there, but the winner's been announced.
The 2025 South Australian Agricultural Talent of the Year winner is Leno.
Lots of excitement in the room for Lamoureux last night, your 2025 Ag Town of the Year, and we're going to cross there very shortly. Lots and lots of excitement. But also today, what is fair compensation for farmers who host transmission lines on their property? Is it a one-off payment when those transmission lines are first installed, or should it be ongoing index payments over the life of those lines on your farm? Can you hear your thoughts on this one? You'll hear from a regional mayor and farmer later on in the program who is arguing for a rethink on the payments for farmers who host transmission lines. Happy to hear your thoughts. 1300 160222 is the talkback number, or the text line is 0467 922783. But yes, first today, the Mallee town of Lamoureux has been named the winner of the 2025 Ag Town of the Year award, announced last night at the Regional Showcase Awards in Adelaide. So Lamoureux's been recognised for leading the way in sustainable farming, innovation and agricultural education. The judges said the town was making the most of its location and opportunities, using its surrounds to strengthen both local industry and community life. So some of the comments from the independent judging panel, they praised the town for stamping ag on everything and recognised the region as a food bowl, home to major ag businesses such as potato, carrot and onion producer Pie Group and McPiggery, which is pioneering closed-loop systems and sustainability. Lamoureux was also commended for its resilience and community spirit during a particularly difficult year, with producers facing prolonged dry conditions. So let's go to Lamoureux, and a business that got a shout-out there, the Pie Group, and Renee Pie joins me. Renee, welcome to The Country. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So fantastic news for Lamoureux. What was your reaction to the news when you heard the town had won?
I was very excited. I felt like everyone, even in the office, were on the edge of their seats yesterday, sort of waiting to hear what the results were.
Fantastic. And I understand as part of the process where the judges came and had a look at your place on the day?
Yes. Yeah, they did. It was really nice to have them out. They had a good look around.
And you guys got a shout out as part of the announcement for the win as sort of, you know, something great that Lamoureux is doing in the ag space. Tell us a bit more about what you do at Pie and what you grow, how big you are and how long you've been there.
I actually had no idea that we got a shout out last night, but that's nice to hear. We started growing potatoes, carrots and onions here in the early 90s on a centre pivot irrigation scheme, just starting out with three employees, including my parents. So things have definitely expanded since then. We're now sort of across 55,000 hectares of land, and we have around 500 employees sort of on an annual basis. So the business has definitely grown, and we wouldn't have been able to do it without the support of the community and the town itself.
You're obviously, now that you're a major employer there, you're a part of the fabric of Lamoureux.
Yes, no, definitely. I call myself a local.
And you grow a bit there, as you mentioned, a few different commodities. Where do you supply into?
So we are supplying the three major supermarkets, and then we're also supplying processing companies like McCain and Lamb Weston.
What makes Lamoureux such a great place to run an operation like yours?
Well, there's a great source of underground water, which works well when you're growing horticultural produce, but also the community and council are really supportive in developing the town with new housing and different complexes, as well as, you know, there's a great school for my kids as well as our employees' kids to go to.
And the last couple of years have obviously been some very dry, some very tough conditions? Has it really sort of tested the resilience of your operation and the community as a whole?
Yeah, most certainly. And there's been a lot of different support programs that have come out from that. So you've seen that it's been quite helpful, you know, over the last few years for different people in the community when they've been needing it.
What do you reckon this means for the town, for the folks there like yourself to be able to say we're the Ag Town of the Year? Is it just a nice little boost that perhaps everyone needs now?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think everyone would be very proud waking up to hear that news. So it'd be a great boost for everyone.
Excellent. Well, Renee, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Congratulations to you, to Lamoureux, to everyone involved. You're going to get a fantastic sign up there at a big celebration. I'm sure everyone will be really looking forward to letting their hair down and celebrating that.
Yeah, definitely. Close to Christmas, which makes it good too.
Renee Pye from the Pye Group at Lamoureux. And as I mentioned, Lamoureux was recognised particularly for its innovation, resilience and community spirit. And Nicole McMahon is the chair of the Lamoureux Forward Committee, and she says that the town embodies those in many ways.
Oh, I think we showed it across a few aspects, and we ticked a lot of boxes. So from Lamoureux Forward and all the community effort, we've done in the last few years, especially like with the silo up, which was, you know, fully community driven, but that really showed our agricultural roots and our agricultural story across the two silos. So there was that. There was, you know, all that's happened and the growth in the community from our horticultural industries with their potatoes, especially, and you know how that's driven, I guess, population growth. But some incredible innovation within that industry across our broadacre. Obviously, a really marginal farming area, and another couple of tough years. But just seeing, what farmers are doing, you know, to make the best out of a bad season, and especially women in ag. Like, we've got some incredible leaders in our community across all our industries. So I think I feel like the judges, you know, just wouldn't have known where to look. We threw a lot at them. It was a whirlwind of a half-day tour. Just so incredibly proud of our community.
What was that process like when the judges came to town? You said it was a whirlwind. What did you actually do?
Oh, it was, and I think it was partly because we had three judges come, and we only had a half day to, you know, and not everything's in Lamoureux. We drove out to the Pye's potatoes, Zarella, showed them through the packaging facility. This is a credible, you know, $42 million state-of-the-art packaging facility. And then we went out to, show them some irrigation, show them how, you know, a potato crop, and talk about our underground water, because that's something that really makes our region unique. And then out to McPiggery, to show them what's happening out there. And then we finished with a big community event out at Mallee Spirits. So it sounds simple, but there was quite a few games. So we were talking to them in the van, you know, giving them as much information as we could. As I said, throwing a lot at them. I think they usually allow a day, but because of the judges' schedules, we just had to pack it all into half a day.
Well, did you get feedback from the judges? Have you heard anything back of from what they saw, what they did? Obviously, you won, so that's a big feedback.
Yeah, very, very close lip up until this point in time, and we did chat with them a little bit afterwards. I guess they told us what we already knew, how good things are, you know. Not how good things are, but, you know, how hard we are working at a lot of these things just to make our community a great place to live. I want my kids to want to live there. We want people to come and move to Lamoureux to work in Lamoureux. And it's, you know, we're a small rural town. We've only got a population of, 800. So it's not a big town. So, really proud.
Yeah, and just to pull this together as well, Pinneroo was the inaugural winner of the Ag Town of the Year Award in 2020. So now we've got two towns in the Southern Mallee who've won this.
Yes, so special. And obviously, best friends / rivals, Pinneroo, and that probably did motivate us even more to win. You get this big, beautiful sign. So we wanted one of those signs. And I think, though, funny enough, I can still remember watching when Pinneroo won that, and they released a beautiful little short video, and thinking, gosh, like, good on Pinneroo for going for that. And they were doing some great things. And I think that really shows how far Lamoureux has come, especially in the last few years. We've probably been head down, bum up, and we've taken a chance to, look up and be able to tell our story and, about a few great things that are happening in Lamoureux.
Nicole McMahon there. She's the chair of the Lamoureux Forward Committee, and she was speaking with Matt Stevens. So, yes, again, massive congratulations to Lamoureux, our 2025 Ag Town of the Year, but also a big congratulations to the other two finalists, Keith and Kimber. So Lamoureux will get, as part of its prize, a sign for the town entrance, recognising its achievements. There'll be a community celebration event to come, a trophy, and lots of exposure showcasing the town's contribution to the state. So previous winners, Panola last year, Woodner 2023, Mike Longer in 2022. Kimber won it back in 2021 and again a finalist this year. And then, as I mentioned there, Pinneroo in 2020. And Cleve was the inaugural winner back in 2019. It is 15 minutes past 12.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Selena Green with you today, tripping over her words, but warming up, we'll get there. It's 15 minutes past 12. Let's talk about harvest, because that has got underway, even if it is a little slow and stop-start for some. But Teaport says it's been receiving a steady stream of drop-offs in the past few weeks. This also comes as the company is up for sale, with CEO Nathan Kent saying that they have had some interest. Brooke Neindorf caught up with him to find out about the sale, but also to ask about how harvest has started.
So, yeah, for us, harvest has started. So 25-26 has officially kicked off, which is exciting to see. And for us, we've already taken a few thousand tonnes of lentils as the beginning of harvest. And so we're accepting lentils at all sites this year at Teaports. So that's Wallaroo, that's Kimber, Lock, and obviously Lucky Bay. So that's quite exciting for us. But as you say, the recent rainfalls over the last 7 to 10 days is delaying a lot of the starts for our growers in our catchments. And probably across the whole state, I'd suggest.
What's the quality of the lentils like coming through?
So far, it's all been really good. Yeah, so it's such early days, but the quality's been very good. No issues there from our side.
Where has it mainly been coming from?
At the moment, we've had a couple of loads into Wallaroo, but most of it's over the Lucky Bay side, over on the Eyre Peninsula.
Just in terms of prices, what are growers seeing at the moment, particularly with this recent weather? Has that had much of an impact?
Yeah, so we've been doing a lot of pre-harvest meetings. So there's been over 200 growers that have caught up with Hayley Lewis, who's our grower relations manager. And she's been talking a lot about pricing with our two major buyers, which are AGE and LDC. And the pricing, it's been stable. It's been competitive in Teaports. Growers are talking that it's not high, but it's been stable and competitive in our system, which is really good and good to see. And I think the other call out is we've welcomed a third cereals buyer in our system as well, which is Quadra Commodities. So that really helps with providing growers across our different catchments more choice of how they're going to market their grain. So I think that's helping with pricing as well.
Nathan, you've got a new program this year as well that's looking to help out with local community projects. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we're launching this year a program called Grain for Good. And it's all about, as we go around and talk with more of our catchment, more of our growers, understanding what's important to our region and getting really targeted and focused on can we do anything in partnership with our growers to give back to the regions. So for every tonne that a grower brings into Teaports, any site, this year in our system, all they need to do is nominate what's important to them. It might be a local sporting club, might be a local rotary. They'll get a list of choices that they get from us, and we'll give 50 cents for every tonne that they bring in back to that interest of theirs, which we want to see the regions thrive. We want to see some of those local sporting clubs where you hear the stories that they'd love to have something extra that they could do for the training of their teams, and if we can give something back in partnership with the growers, I think it's a great story. So that's launching this year. We think it'll end up giving up something like around about maybe over 160,000 in total back to our catchment, back to those clubs and community interest projects. So that's really exciting, and the growers just need to jump onto either our app or when they deliver in person and sign up for the program, and we'll take care of the rest.
Nathan, we heard a few months ago that Teaports was up for sale. Can you tell us about that and the decision behind that and what the process is at the moment, and has there been interest?
It's one of those things where you talk about what you can talk about. We're in the middle of a process at the moment, so it's hard to certainly can't name companies that are coming and talking to us at this stage, unfortunately. But I would estimate that we've gone out to the market, we've gauged interest, and I would say we're about halfway through that process of finding out. We've sent information packs, and it's all about port investment and opportunity in grain. We've sent that both domestically and globally, and it's been really encouraging what's come back, both. So companies domestically in Australia are having a really good look at what they can do to invest with us, and also from outside of Australia as well, there's been interest. So that's at the moment been along the lines of things like site visits to the port and then us going and meeting with those particular companies in person and having those discussions as well, which, yeah, interest has been very high. But we sort of expected that, to be honest. It's quite unique to have an investment in a port, potentially even the opportunity to own a port, and then you talk about what you get out of it in our region, which is all the conversations have been around how good the quality of grain is in South Australia, how unique it is to be able to own a port that ships grain. But yeah, the quality of South Australian grain's been a topic, and then it drifts quickly into overall global food security discussions and how you can support that through what we've built in South Australia. So early days yet, I'd say, as I say, halfway through. I'd love to be able to talk more openly about it, but I'm thinking maybe I can come back in the new year, early new year, with more information for you, Brooke.
What was the reasoning behind the sale, Nathan, and will it change much for growers that have been a part of Teaports already?
I would say at this stage that it's hard to know. Like, when your conversations I can only gauge the conversations we're having at the moment. It sounds like it's going to be very much business as usual. The brand Teaports is established. It's got a strong reputation. It's building out in the community. So it's not something that you, from a brand point of view, that you would change. I think it'd be more in the lines of what's happening in the investment side behind the brand to give it more growth, more capital into the business to keep looking at things like more upcountry sites, ability to store more grain, that sort of thing.
And so all those upcountry sites are part of the deal, and including also the Lucky Air, which is the transshipment vessel?
That's right. And including, we have some additional surplus land, which is undeveloped at the moment, which when you're talking, they could become much larger areas for storing grain as well and feeding those two ports. So that's included in the conversation as well.
And just, Nathan, just back to just before, was there a particular reason for the sale of Teaports, or is it that investment opportunity?
I think it's the structure of how our parent company, which we're owned by ICAM, and their private fund, it's just reached its fund maturity life, and it's looking now for the next level of growth investment. So they've done the early steps of getting it built and constructed, and really now it's time. That's hit a maturity point. Time for it to be handed over to the next person that can inject another range of capital into it that can keep it growing.
That's Teaport CEO Nathan Kent there speaking with Brooke Neindorf. Well, speaking of companies changing hands, an announcement today about Cargill completing its acquisition of Tees Beef Processing. So an announcement today by Cargill. They've announced that Cargill and Tees Investments Pty Limited have completed the successful ownership transition of Tees Australia and Tees USA. Cargill now holds 100% ownership. And this follows approval, according to Cargill, of all regulatory requirements. That includes the clearance from the Australian Foreign Investment Review Board and relevant authorities in their export markets. So in their statement, Cargill says this acquisition marks a significant milestone in the long-standing partnership between the Tees family and Cargill, which has spanned more than 14 years. The transition of ownership to Cargill ensures long-term stability for Tees people, partners and producers, while continuing to honour the company's 75-year legacy of integrity, quality and trust. Cargill says with the completion of the change of ownership to Cargill, Andrew McPherson, who was announced last month as the new CEO of Tees, he'll assume his leadership role effective immediately. Andrew's based in Brisbane and will be responsible for driving Tees operations forward as, quote, a leading provider of healthy, high-quality Australian beef products and a buyer of Australian livestock destined for local and international customers. So Tees currently employs about 5,000 people across its two primary operating companies, Tees Australia and Tees USA, but now 100% owned by Cargill. It's just going on 24 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green. Well, let's go back to the issue of harvest and crops. And a data tracking service for Australian agriculture says more than 100,000 hectares of Victoria's wheat crop has already been cut for hay. Digital Agriculture Services says that state has had a difficult season, but much more crop has made grain in other states, like here in South Australia and in WA as well. Sam Atkinson leads the organisation's Earth Observation and Data Science team. He says satellite tracking of the nation's ag is being used to keep track of production.
We try to estimate what's growing where, how much of it, and to track it through the key stages of the season, such as when it gets harvested, if it gets cut for hay, when it gets cut for hay. Yeah, and that's sort of it, data that we provide through to industry.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you do that? Like, what are you watching for?
Yeah, for sure. So most of what we do is based off applying machine learning to satellite imagery, or AI. Everyone calls it AI now. I probably should get on that boat. And so that's essentially what we do. We process a lot of satellite imagery, develop machine learning models that predict what the crop type is, or for wheat, barley, canola, what the yield is, if the paddock's been cut for hay from one day to the next or harvested from one day to the next. We process that through to kind of aggregated statistics by region.
Being able to tell the wheat from a barley crop, or if it's been cut for hay or harvested, is that hard to do?
It is relatively hard to do. Things have got much easier in the last few years. There's been obviously a lot of development with machine learning as a science, but also computational power now is much higher than it was even 5 years ago in terms of the cost and accessibility of that. And that's really the enabling technology that supports us to do what we're doing.
So good satellite imagery, better and stronger computers that can make decisions faster, and they're learning all the time. So that's now getting you to the point where you can keep an eye on what's happening here in the crops. And take me into the story of this season, because what piqued my eye was the work that you're doing around whether wheat crops and other crops in Victoria are being cut for hay, or if they're going through to grain in what has been a difficult season. What are you seeing?
It has been another challenging season for Victoria and South Australian growers. And I think one of the more interesting things from my point of view this year has been the amount of particularly wheat that's been cut for hay. And I think that probably tells a bit of a story about what growers have been looking at in terms of both the weather forecast and where their crops are at over the last month. And, seems like a lot of them have made that decision to cut them for hay.
So what kind of area has been cut for hay from wheat?
At the moment, and there's still a bit to go, I think, in particularly the western districts, depending on how much they cut for hay. But at the moment, we've got 105,000 hectares of wheat being detected as cut for hay in Victoria, which is about nearly 7% of the entire wheat area, and about twice as much as we saw cut for hay last year. And it was a reasonable amount cut for hay last year based off, again, not great seasonal conditions, but probably a bit more frost getting around last year as well.
Wow, is my response to that, in that sense that it really shows you wheat not traditionally a crop that farmers would be cutting for hay. Most of them would be taking it through to grain, but if up to 7% has been cut already, that seems significant.
It really is. Potentially that could have gone through to, around 300,000 tonnes of wheat grain production, although I think if growers are cutting that much, they probably didn't think it was going to get through to that potential. So that makes sense.
And in terms of other states and other regions, how does Victoria compare?
Certainly with wheat and barley, that's the most that's been cut. In South Australia, it's pretty similar to last year in terms of the amount of wheat and barley that's been cut for hay. And in WA, not much has been cut for hay, but certainly a lot of oats, around 200,000 hectares of oats in WA have been cut for hay. But it has been a record oat planting in WA as well.
And given your work here, and obviously that story from Victoria is a really interesting story of the season and the drought and the conditions farmers have been facing, but does it give you a good insight into how big the crop is then for Australia across sort of multiple of these grain categories?
We have production estimates. We're putting it somewhere around about 35 million tonnes for wheat nationally. About 16 million tonnes for barley and 7 million for canola.
And how does that compare, I suppose, to the traditional survey-type methods and other estimates that come out from some of the banks and government services?
The kind of the traditional approach to crop forecasting was have your best estimate of what's happened in the past and then apply some sort of modifier to this year, 5% more, 10% less, that sort of thing. Which in general is kind of pretty effective. Where that traditional methodology kind of struggles is where you get big changes. The rapid increase in lentil plantings in Victoria and South Australia are a good example of that, where kind of the more traditional methods, it's kind of hard to say, well, it's going to be a 20% increase in a particular crop. That's kind of a big call when you're basing that off what you're hearing and what you're surveying, whereas our methodology can be really kind of precise in capturing those big and sudden changes in what happens.
Sam Atkinson there. He leads the Earth Observation and Data Science team at Digital Agricultural Services, and he was speaking there to Warwick Long. That takes us almost to 12:30. I'm running super late for the weather, so let's go there now and say hello to Hannah Marsh. Hi, Hannah, and thanks for waiting for us.
Good afternoon, Selena. No worries at all.
So what's going on with the weather today?
Well, we've got a cold front that's just approaching the far west of the state at the moment. Ahead of that, we do have a large area of cloud, mid-level and high-level cloud associated with this system. We've also seen some thunderstorm activity associated with this system in the west. In terms of shower activity, there's quite a bit showing up on the weather watch radar, but it is pretty high-based, and we've only seen falls of generally less than 2 millimetres so far, with 2 millimetres at Cummins being the highest. And those falls have generally been about Eyre Peninsula and central districts so far. As the day progresses, we will see that shower and thunderstorm activity gradually moving eastwards. There is the possibility of seeing some severe thunderstorms in the far west, with damaging wind gusts, large hail and heavy rainfall possible. As these thunderstorms do continue to move eastwards into tomorrow, we do see them weaken, but there is again the possibility of seeing some damaging wind gusts about the northeast pastoral district and eastern parts of the northern agricultural area. Having a look at the temperatures for today, it's been up to 33 at Oodnadatta and 32 at Moomba so far. And then looking at the lower end, so far it's just reached 15 degrees at Mount Lofty and 16 degrees at Mount Gambier. With the large amount of cloud that we do have over us, we are looking at above average minimum temperatures for overnight tonight and into tomorrow morning, with minimums 2 to 8 degrees above average, particularly about central and eastern parts for the overnight period. As we head into tomorrow, we will see that shower and possible thunderstorm activity about central and eastern districts. It will clear to the east during the day, particularly the thunderstorms, but we will see those isolated showers persisting, particularly about the coasts into the evening. Maximum temperatures tomorrow, we're still looking at them being above average in the northeast, but below average elsewhere. So looking at maximums of 20 degrees for Ceduna and Port Lincoln, Whyalla 25, 29 tomorrow at Cooper Pedy, 30 for Roxby Downs, 35 for Oodnadatta, 32 at Renmark, 27 for Murray Bridge, 23 at Clare, 22 for Mount Barker, 23 also at Victor Harbour, and looking at 20 at Kingscote and Mount Gambier. We're also seeing winds are starting to increase about western and central parts associated with this system, and that will continue into tomorrow as well. A high pressure system moves in pretty quickly behind the front, which will see the shower activity clear out to the east, but we do have a weak front that we're expecting just to clip the south of the state as we head into Monday and into Tuesday. So we're generally looking at stable conditions behind this initial system until we do see that weak system just move through the south. In terms of cumulative rainfall totals up until Monday, we're generally looking at less than 2 millimetres about the pastoral districts and northern agricultural areas. That'll increase to 2 to 10 millimetres about the west coast district and southern agricultural area, with some isolated falls of 5 to 15 millimetres about Windward Coasts and Ranges and also about the lower southeast. We could also see some isolated falls of 10 to 30 millimetres possible. That will mainly be with thunderstorms with this system today, overnight and into tomorrow.
Thanks, Hannah. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Hannah Marsh there from the Weather Bureau. For the western inland parts of New South Wales, Friday will be partly cloudy in the upper western district with a slight chance of a shower. There's a chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening.
Winds northeasterlies 15 to 25 k's an hour, turning northwesterlies 30 to 45 k's an hour in the early afternoon, then turning northwest to southwesterlies 25 to 35 k's an hour in the evening. Overnight temperatures between 17 and 21 degrees during the day in the mid to high 30s. For the lower western district, partly cloudy, there's a slight chance of a shower, chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening. North to northeasterly winds 25 to 40 k's an hour, shifting west to southwesterlies 30 to 45 k's an hour in the afternoon. Overnight, falling between 15 and 19 degrees. During the day, the temperatures there should reach the mid to high 30s. It's just going on 25 minutes to one.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Coming up in this next half an hour, there's a question. What is fair compensation for farmers whose land hosts transmission lines? If you'd like to weigh in on this one, you'll hear from one local mayor and farmer what he thinks needs a bit of a rethink on that issue. My talkback number is 1300 160 222 or the text line's 0467 922 783. You're also going to meet a First Nations wine business here in South Australia that's making history as a finalist in a major export award. That's all to come after news headlines with Matt Coleman. Good afternoon, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the childcare regulator has cancelled the registration of just one provider in almost 4 years, and there's been no action taken on nearly 10,000 complaints. Data given to the ABC under Freedom of Information shows the Education Standards Board did not prosecute any childcare provider between the start of 2020 and near the end of 2024. The Education Minister Blair Boyer says the majority of complaints were handled appropriately, but says there were times the regulator's response fell short. The Federal Environment Minister says it's too early to say what concessions the government is willing to make to pass its environment laws through Parliament. The changes are expected to pass the House of Representatives today, where Labor has the numbers, but will need support from either the Greens or the Coalition to get through the Senate. The Minister, Murray Watt, says he is prepared to make changes to the bill to ensure it goes through. And the Mallee town of Lamoureux was named SA Agricultural Town of the Year at a regional showcase held in the Adelaide Hills last night. The Primary Industries Minister Claire Scriven says the town has been recognised for its innovative and sustainable farming practices. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those news headlines. So how should farmers be compensated for hosting transmission lines on their land? It's a question certainly heightened at the moment by the debate around the Northern Transmission Project, the NTX, and the potential pathway of the high voltage transmission line connecting the state's north to Greater Adelaide. And we've been hearing from farmers who are worried the project will come at the cost of prime agricultural land. I mean, hundreds of residents attended a recent meeting in the mid-north, and last night the Goyder Council held a public meeting to hear people's views on the project as well. I was looking in today's advertiser, and the Mayor of Light Regional Council, Bill Close, penned a letter to the editor saying while he welcomed the construction of the network, farmers shouldn't be financially disadvantaged and the compensation offered to them needs to be changed. He joins me now, Mayor, welcome and good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Selena.
Your letter to the editor today, what prompted you to write it?
Well, there's a huge amount of frustration with the farmers and the path of the NTX transmission lines, and one of the major problems is that they aren't compensated properly for any suffering or damage that may occur or, you know, interference with their farming life. And, you know, if you have a wind farm, you get paid a lease fee for that windmill on your property, but for a transmission line, you get a once-off payment, and that's it for in perpetuity. So it just doesn't seem fair or equitable.
Just talk us through, you outline a bit of your own personal experience in this. You've got a farm yourself and transmission lines run through that. So was that the case for you, that for that property it was a once-off payment and then that sort of ish?
Yes, absolutely, Selena. Yes, we've got, we're on part of the Port Augusta line that's been pumping power down to Adelaide for many years, but it goes right across my property. My grandfather was paid a few hundred dollars, not thousands, £100 it was in those days. And for that right, the power lines have easement and the ability to drive through my property at any time they wish to check their power lines. So it's been a nuisance for us for many years, but, you know, it seems unfair that my grandfather was paid, but we get no compensation now, and it was a pittance, really, when it was purchased.
And why do you argue that ongoing payments are necessary? What sort of inconvenience or cost is it, you know, once those lines are established or those towers established, to have them there ongoing? What cost does that create for the farmer?
Well, the major cost is interference with your farming machinery. You've got, if it's a certain distance from the paddock, from the fence, you can't spray behind it, so you get a weed burden in that area. You just can't get your machinery past some of the spots between the transmission lines and the fences. And you've also restricted if you have aerial spraying done, which, you know, they can't spray under the power lines. So it has, you know, serious issues in that area. It's also a major biosecurity risk of people travelling over your property at different times of the year. You don't know who's, you know, well, you know they're coming, but that's about all you know. So it is a serious issue with biosecurity.
Do you see it as an increased fire risk as well? Is that another cause?
Well, yes, it is. You know, they've got a serious amount of power going through those lines, and certainly in a thunderstorm time, they do attract lightning, and obviously that's a risk if you've got the dry crops underneath it. So it certainly is a worry. I was quite concerned the other day with the power. The thunderstorms were crashing and my crops, unwrapped crops beneath them. So it is a concern, yeah.
What would you see, what would you feel would be, a fair compensation for landholders and for farmers in particular to allow these types of infrastructure to be on their properties?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because every property is different and every degree of farming is affected by in different ways. So that would have to be valued on each property, I think. If you're going through vineyard areas or just through grazing land or whatever, there'd be different compensations. But once that compensation is agreed to, I think it should be adjusted on a yearly basis so that the farmer is being compensated for his damage. And I'm certain that farmers would be more agreeable to that sort of payment than to a one-off payment. You know, they would make things a lot smoother for them and for their future generations.
Obviously, these projects need to happen. There is that need for the rolling out of more connections for these power sources. But do you think it would be a disincentive if farmers, if there was a requirement for ongoing payments for farmers when these lines are rolled out? Do you think it would be a disincentive for these sorts of projects to happen?
I don't think so, because they've got to happen anyway, and there are payments, lease payments that are paid in other states, so I don't see why we can't be any different to that. I think it would be far more less angst with the community if it was paid that way, and would be no extra burden for the pieces. Obviously, they probably wouldn't pay as much up front because they're only paying it for the easement, but they'd be paying on an annual basis, so I think it would make everyone happier.
What's your understanding of how this would need to happen? I mean, would this just be the goodwill of the companies deciding to make this part of their compensation program, or would this need some sort of government intervention to make this the case?
I'm not exactly sure, Selena, but I would assume it would be a government action to say this is what we want to happen. I mean, there's government sold the rights to the Electronet, or not Electronet, but Electronet now. So that would have to be probably redrawn up by the government to change that method of payment.
Bill Close, Mayor Close, thanks very much for joining us on the Country Hour today. Thanks for making some time for us.
Good, Selena. I just hope we've got to have the transmissions lines. There's no doubt about it, but let's make it agreeable with everybody. Thank you.
The Mayor of Light Regional Council, Bill Close, that's speaking about his letter to the editor in the Advertiser today. It is 17 minutes away from one.
This week on Landline, the menace of feral pigs.
They can take your potential production and halve it. Pigs can do a lot of damage, and they do a lot of damage to country.
That's Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're with Selena Green on this Thursday. Well, let's celebrate a South Australian wine label that is making history. It's become a finalist for an export award recognising First Nations businesses.
Trailblazing regional South Australian business Munda Wines is one of six finalists in Austrade's Australian Export Awards category for First Nations exporters. And in fact, it's the first time in the award's 63-year history that it has had a standalone category for First Nations businesses. Munda Wines owner and founder is Paulie Vandenberg. Paulie, welcome to the Country Hour.
Thank you, and thanks for having me. Really exciting.
And yeah, exciting news. Congratulations on the winery being a finalist in these export awards. What does it mean to you to get to this point?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, when you sort of set out to create a business, you don't really think about the awards that you're sort of eligible for. But I guess it's pretty flattering and humbling. And yeah, we're quite excited. And we, you know, to win the state one was a bit of a surprise as well. Then to go into the national awards is just equally exciting as well. So it's definitely one of the visions and goals of Munda Wines to, you know, get more into the export market. But we're certainly very grateful for this opportunity.
Take us back to the history of Munda Wines, how it came to be.
Yeah, it's kind of bit of a strange one. I tell the story quite a bit. I actually have a tuna business as well out of Port Lincoln. So my family and community own sort of 30 ton of tuna quota, Southern Bluefin. So really exciting project there as well. But I guess when we were thinking about launching that as a business, we wanted to partner with an Indigenous wine company, and we kind of discovered that it was pretty limited to no wine labels. So I thought, why not have a crack at that? I enjoy a wine, and that's kind of the genesis of it all. And then as I started thinking about the story behind the wine, what was going to give me a little bit of a different angle, because it is quite a flooded market. And then I just kind of started thinking about, you know, could I use this opportunity to help educate Australia about more about my people? And that was probably where it really came to a head, where we wanted to not take anything away from all these beautiful wine regions like McLaren Vale and Barossa and the Yarra Valley. That's still quite important to us and our story. But we wanted people to pick up one of our bottles and understand that McLaren Vale is actually also Kaurna country, and that the Barossa Valley is also the Ngadjeri and the Turrumung people. And I think that's really resonated with people. It's not something we're trying to put in people's faces too much. It's just, I guess, we keep using this word coexisting. So having an opportunity to be in an industry that's international and global just gives us more opportunities to help educate people about, you know, the 65,000 years of culture in Australia.
Yeah, as you say, it's such a big market, it is hard to stand out. And I think we're hearing increasingly that wine consumers are, you know, interested in looking for the story behind the wine, and you can't really get much of a bigger, better, older story than the history of, the oldest living culture in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I sometimes the word unique is probably overused in the wine industry, but I really do feel like we have a really unique platform and opportunity here with Munda Wines in terms of, you know, we are one label and we have a real national footprint with our wines. You know, we've got a beautiful Chardonnay out of Margaret River, you know, beautiful Pinot Noir out of Yarra Valley. We just launched the Sparkling out of Tasmania. So we've got these beautiful wines, 8 wines at the moment, right across Australia. And I think that's the opportunity to tell just as many stories as possible from those regions. Also gives me an opportunity to also work closely with the traditional owners who I've formed some really unique relationships as well with, who really want this idea of helping non-Aboriginal people about those regions, you know. And it's not my story to tell, it's their story to tell, but I just want to be able to help give them that platform so they can tell that story.
We're talking to you today as Munda Wines has been named a finalist for these export awards. So you are exporting, where are you exporting into, and how difficult has that journey been to break into the export market?
Yeah, it's been quite difficult. It's a bit of a challenge, as most people would understand exporting. But Malaysia was actually our first country that had a real interest in our wines, which was fantastic. And then it kind of just, wouldn't say snowballed, it's just taken a little bit of careful sort of strategic sort of approach to everything. And then we've been fortunate enough to get into Canada, which is really exciting. I think the opportunities and the partnerships we're creating in Canada at the moment is, yeah, really exciting for us as Munda Wines, particularly with their real passion and commitment towards their Indigenous people. So that seems to be really resonating. And then we just returned from Japan with Austrade, which was a fantastic opportunity for us to be there. And then we're in negotiating at the moment with the US market. So I again, equally exciting. But yeah, it's been a challenge, and we never thought we would be here so quickly. And then, you know, when you start up a wine business, you don't know how much wine to make just in case it doesn't work. But it seems to be all going in the right direction at the moment.
Fantastic. Yeah, I've heard that Canadian market and the US, they're particularly tough to break into because they have some quite unique structures around how their wine is distributed, isn't it? So I think once you're in there, that's just to get in a foot in the door is a big challenge.
Yeah, it has been. And I guess for me, it's been I think we're in a pretty, again, I don't want to keep using this word unique, but we're in this unique position where the people that we're talking with is actually the native. So in the US, we've been talking with the Native American Chamber of Commerce, and equally into Canada as well. And so I think that's another opportunity for talk about the Indigenous people of all three countries. And that's the angle we're using. So my in is basically with the Native Americans and Native Canadian people, and I'm just really excited to learn more about them and their people, and equally they're just as excited to learn about us. And you know, to get my mother involved in it as well is something that brings a smile to my face, because she's feeling really proud of where Munda's going, but also her having the opportunity to speak to sort of the chiefs of those different tribes over in the US and in Canada is something that we feel like it's not so much about the wine, it's more about the people, and you know, how can we tell more stories about the people.
Incredible. No wonder she's very happy about that. What an incredible experience. Well, Paulie, all the best with the awards. No matter what happens, it sounds like things are growing great for the wine. So what are you sort of hoping you for the future? What's the ultimate goal?
Yeah, I reckon the ultimate goal, obviously having some really great partnerships in the export industry, and I think that would be really cool with different countries. But I think that our biggest goal is to really have an impact here in Australia in the domestic market, and just getting our wines on the table. And what we're seeing is a real growth in the high end sort of restaurants. But also, we want it to be affordable for my people as well, so that they get an opportunity to be a part of it. One of the things I actually get a lot of questions from my family is, look, we don't drink, so can you make a non-alcoholic one? So, you know, it's pretty cool when you're thinking about that. They really want to support it, but, you know, there's this thing that a lot of my people and family don't actually drink. So, but, yeah, I guess the domestic market is probably something that we really want to keep pushing the envelope on and create these opportunities to have a platform to help educate. But, you know, we're not sure where it's going to go. Hopefully there's a home for Munda where people can actually visit as well and have a bit of a cultural immersion experience as well. I think that would be really cool as well. But at the moment, we just feel like we're in a good trajectory, and hopefully things keep improving. And, you know, I guess I want to say, you know, congratulations to all the nominees, and, you know, all the best for everyone going forward.
Fantastic. It's a wonderful, positive story. We love to hear it. Paulie, thanks so much for joining us on the Country Hour today, and all the best.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me.
Munda Wines owner and founder Paulie Vandenberg there. Earlier I spoke with Austrade's Head of Indigenous Engagement and Export, Melanie Harris, about the decision to create a new standalone First Nations Export Award.
We've always been trying to encourage Indigenous businesses to apply for the regular award categories, and this particular award doesn't actually stop them from applying for any of the other award categories, and we actively encourage that as well. But it was time to stop and have a separate one to acknowledge the great work that Indigenous businesses are doing on the global stage.
So just give us a bit of an idea. If you look across Australia, regional Australia, are there a lot of Indigenous owned and run businesses that are doing export?
Yeah, well, we've got about 400 businesses on our records, and that's an exhaustive list. It's just the list that we have at the moment. And, you know, those businesses are all over Australia and in different sectors as well. So, and, you know, it's quite well known that Indigenous businesses that export actually employ more people. They, you know, put more money back into the economy. And, you know, when it's in regional Australia, that's even better.
Talk a bit about how Austrade, the work that Austrade does then to support businesses like these that are exporting to, I guess, grow what they do.
Well, as I mentioned before, that we've got so many businesses on our records, and we've complemented our network with our colleagues in the TradeStart network, who are effectively in most regional areas in Australia as well. So between them and us and our online tools, there's a lot of things that we can do that we already do to support Indigenous businesses. businesses and other exporters alike. So on our Go Global toolkit, we have export readiness quizzes that are is really simple and that helps to provide guidance on your next steps depending on what you answer to those questions. The Go Global toolkit also has an export academy. It's called Go Global Academy, actually, where you'll find webinars that focus on market or export-related topics. And, for example, we have an IP webinar coming up on the 18th of November for Indigenous businesses. And last month we had an Export Essentials webinar for Indigenous businesses. So it's a bit of both, like doing some things that are just at making sure Indigenous businesses are able to access already existing webinars and market information and overseas trade missions and global events, but also sometimes we realise that we need to stop and have a look at something that's a bit more specific to Indigenous businesses or needs to go a bit deeper for Indigenous businesses like IP.
It is a wonderfully, I guess, unique Australian story. It's something that unique that we can sell to the world. Is there a lot of great interest, you know, from our trading partners to see authentically Indigenous-owned businesses and something unique coming out of Australia that we can send to the rest of the world?
Oh, absolutely. And for a lot of our trading partners, you know, sometimes it's the first time they've heard of this Indigenous culture. And just having seen firsthand in Southeast Asia and just recently in Japan, the response from, you know, those countries on the Indigenous culture and just the understanding of, the automatic understanding, I would say, of the synergies between our cultures, you know, that protecting the earth, protecting our culture, family, you know, all those things, you know, alternative medicines, that sort of stuff is quite common in some parts of the world. And us having the oldest living culture is just a great story and a unique story that people are interested in.
That's Melanie Harris there. She's the head of Indigenous Engagement and Export at Austrade. And the winners of the Australian Export Awards will be announced on the 26th of November. You're with Selena Green. It's 4 minutes away from one. Speaking of awards, you've only got a few days left if you want to get a nomination in for the second annual South Australian Grain Industry Awards. These are an initiative of Grain Producers SA, and they're to recognise individuals that have made outstanding contributions to the state's agricultural contributor, the grains industry. The awards include six categories. There'll be awards for Grain Producer and Young Grain Producer of the Year, an Innovation Award, a Women in Grain Award, and the Industry Impact Award. Each category winner will get cash prizes and the Sustainability Award winner will receive a bursary. In addition, the South Australian Grain Industry Hall of Fame will honour individuals, both living and posthumous, who have made long-standing contributions to the state's grain industry. So those nominations close Monday, the 10th of November. They'll be announced on the 15th and winners will be revealed at the South Australian Grain Industry Awards Gala Dinner in February next year. So you've got to hop on this website, sagrainsindustryawards.com.au, and get those nominations in. But as I said, they close 10th of November, which is not too far away. What else is not too far away? The 1 o'clock news. So we better find out what happened in the Mount Compass markets. Brooke Neindorf has those numbers. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Selena. Numbers remained similar as agents offered 755 live weight and open auction cattle. Quality was again extremely mixed as female cattle made up the bulk of numbers and the usual trade and processor buyers were active along with feeders, restockers and specialty butchers, providing steady competition throughout. Feeler quality improved with the best of the calves returning 489 to 529 cents a kilo and 20 cents a kilo dearer. A large draft of 68 dairy steers, 400 kilos to 500 kilos, sold from 343 to 393 cents a kilo, as heavy cows lifted 25 cents to 50 cents a kilo to sell to 465 cents a kilo. Veeler steers sold from 320 to 569 cents, with the best calves up to 20 cents a kilo dearer. Veeler heifers lifted a similar amount as they sold from 269 to 500 cents a kilo. Yearling steers sold from 250 to 495 cents, with light calves easing up to 30 cents a kilo, as heavier weight sold 15 to 20 cents a kilo dearer. Yearling heifers sold from 350 to 471 cents, with heavy weights 15 to 20 cents a kilo Adelaide era. Manufacturing steers sold unchanged, returning 425 to 475 cents a kilo. Grain steers sold mostly unchanged as they ranged from 420 to 475 cents, as grain heifers ranged from 420 to 490 cents, with heavyweights up to 25 cents a kilo dearer. Light beef cows sold from 213 to 350 cents, medium beef cows sold from 300 to 440 cents, and 25 to 30 cents a kilo dearer, as dairy breeds sold to 355 cents a kilo. Heavy beef cows sold from 360 to 465 cents, and 25 to 50 cents a kilo dearer, as dairy breeds ranged from 380 to 413 cents a kilo. A large yarding of 68 bulls sold from 325 to 450 cents a kilo. And these numbers have been provided by John Traeger for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Brooke. That almost takes us up to 1 o'clock in time for the news. Thanks so much for your company today. I'll be back tomorrow at noon to bring you the Country Hour again. And if you'd like to listen back to anything you've missed, find us on the ABC Listen app or just search for South Australian Country Hour. And you can go to our website and find all our podcasts there as well. It's news time. Catch you tomorrow. Have a good one.
Don't fight the static. Hear ABC local radio crystal clear on the ABC Listen app. Download now.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.